Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Boy, he sounded particularly enthusiastic today, especially since he hasn't been on the earth for the last half century. Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, pleased to say that we have the beginning of carnival time, and we have a basketball all-star game. So our cup really doth. And I have to say, in the annals of hope, we have two really brave souls who've gone on record this week. One is Hans Blix, the former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, who said this week in an interview, I believe, to the Independent newspaper in London, that he thinks what he called the debacle in Iraq. How does he get that idea? He thinks that will lead to a situation in which the major powers will never invade another either each other or another country again. Yeah, he actually said that. Because he thinks, you know, the World Bank and everything, we're getting so globalized and interconnected and blah, blah, blah. Hans Blix. And then Brian Boitano, there's no S in that name, Brian Boitano, former Olympic, Winter Olympic champion, and now member of the NBC. NBC's got the Olympics team, said this week he thinks the current situation will ensure that the International Olympic Committee never again awards a games to a country with a troubled human rights record. Okay. So much for hope. We'll look at some change later on in the broadcast, but now...
Here it is!
No, we did that. We're not number one! Yes, this is where we study exactly where we stand in the world, ladies and gentlemen. Because, it's important to not be number one. This is from the people who put out the World Press Freedom Index. They study journalistic freedom in countries around the world. And they've just come out with the 2014 report. And no, we're not. We are not number one. Spain is number 177, just for now rubbing shoulders with the bottom three. Who knew nations had shoulders? But they have soldiers. Maybe that's what they meant. Mali and the Central African Republic, 122nd and 109th, have warfare going on. The group says this proves the negative correlation between open warfare and press freedom. Really, you think? But they also say this, more to the point, countries that pride themselves on being democracies and respecting the rule of law have not set an example. Far from it, freedom of information is far too often sacrificed to an overly broad and abusive interpretation of national security needs, marking a disturbing retreat from democratic practices. This has been the case in the United States, 46th in the world in press freedom, down 13 places from last year. One of the most significant declines because, of all the good stuff we're doing. Increased efforts to track down whistleblowers and the sources of leaks. The United Kingdom is 33rd, just down 3 points. So Britain is 13 places ahead of us, ladies and gentlemen, in press freedom. Don't tell Glenn Greenwald. We're not number one. It is it's something to celebrate. Everything is something to celebrate. That's the New Orleans spirit. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. The Archdiocese of Milwaukee says it's prepared to set aside $4 million in its bankruptcy reorganization. Yes, the Archdiocese is bankrupt. This is a part of its plan to compensate clergy sexual abuse victims. an amount one victim called obscene in its stinginess. Milwaukee is one of 11 Roman Catholic dioceses nationwide to file for bankruptcy in the past decade alone. If approved by a judge, Milwaukee's plan would provide the smallest per-victim payments yet in these cases, $32,000 each for 125 victims. Other dioceses have paid victims hundreds of thousands of dollars, and Milwaukee victims said they thought $400,000 would have been a reasonable offer. So, it's not now Milwaukee is famous not just for the beer, but for the cheese. And slightly to the north, in Dateline Minneapolis, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis said this week it has paid more than $8.8 million in the last 10 years over clergy sexual abuse and other misconduct by priests. The Archdiocese says about $3.2 million of that total went for room, board, and living expenses for priests and ex-priests accused of sexual abuse or other misconduct. That's a sweet deal. The Archdiocese is required by church law to care for such men. No, they're not under the heel of the Vatican. Another $2.5 million went to settlements for victims. Nearly $2.3 million paid for counseling and other support services. That accounts for 54% of the $8.8 million. So almost as much went to settlements for victims as went for room and board and living expenses for the victimizers. The numbers don't include insurance payments. It's the most up-to-date accounting from the diocese through the end of fiscal year, June 30th, 2013. The figures don't reflect any expenses from a wave of fresh allegations that began last fall after a former church employee became a whistleblower and accused top church leaders of mishandling misconduct allegations against priests. Yes, deedly-doodly. We mentioned hope a moment ago. Now, change. The first members of the board of directors of the Barack Obama Presidential Library, two of the three, first in, have strong ties to the private equity industry. This is what used to be called leveraged buyout guys. And increasingly, the private equity industry is not only taking over companies, stripping them, reselling them at a profit. It's also getting into lending that the banks won't do anymore, and the private equity guys can do it and make a profit because they're unregulated. And I guess they're hoping to stay that way. That's why they're on the board of the Presidential Library Foundation. And also in news of change from The Intercept, for 9 years, the U.S. government refused to let a Stanford PhD student named Rahina Ibrahim back in the country after putting her on the no-fly list for no apparent reason. For 8 years, the government lawyers fought her request that she be told why. Last April, despite his promise in 2009 to do so only in the most extreme cases, Attorney General Eric Holder tried to block her case by asserting the state secrets privilege. You didn't hear me say that. Declaring under penalty of perjury that the information she wanted, quote, could reasonably be expected to cause significant harm to national security, unquote. Last week, a federal judge publicly revealed the government's explanation for her long ordeal. An FBI agent had, quote, checked the wrong box. Reason enough for state security privilege, ladies and gentlemen. Hope and change. Hello, welcome to the show.
First stone if you think you see the light at home. I'm back.
from closer to the lake than the river. From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Now news of Alcock. I like this. This is sweet. Dateline Peshawar, Pakistan. Pakistan police say two rival student groups have clashed at a university in the country's northwest. The subject of the clash, whether or not to celebrate Valentine's Day. Isn't that nice? Honey, you listening? Police official Rahim Hussein. Oh, there's that name again. What are we going to do about that? Can he get elected too? Really? Be amazing. Rahim Hussein, he says the violence erupted at the University of Peshawar when dozens of students from a liberal group rallied in favor of Valentine's Day. Their rally was taking place at the same location where conservative students had gathered to promote a modesty day instead. Uh-oh. You see what's happening? Hussein says both sides threw stones at each other, and some students even fired into the air. Four people were hurt. Conservatives in Pakistan every year call for people to boycott Valentine's Day. Yes! Saying it's a Western-inspired event that spreads vulgarity. Well, sentimentality, really, maybe. But the holiday is still widely celebrated in Pakistan, where people buy flowers, pink teddy bears, and heart-shaped balloons. Nothing more need be said, really. Heart-shaped balloons. The world doesn't have enough heart-shaped balloons, ladies and gentlemen. Really. Really, really, really. News of AFPAC. Because we can. Because we care. Because we can still call it AFPAC. And now?
Ladies and gentlemen.
We'll hit the right button one of these days. And you'll be the second to know. Now.
We are proud to present.
This just won't do it. I'm going to say.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it's just pushing the thing. Anyway, news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Won't you? A series of papers recently published by scientists at the American Museum of Natural History suggests that polar bears in the warming Arctic. I think we had that. That's why we had the theme. A new study from North Carolina State University indicates. No, these are all old. What am I doing here? Should I be on the radio at all? More than three quarters of large carnivores now in decline. Had that too. All right. We're covered. We are covered. So, we turn immediately. To the trades. That's where I go when things get rough. I read the trades for you. Calms me right down. Might do the same for you. NPR Archives Project revisits sounds of 1984. I will read it for you. This is from Current, the trade magazine of public broadcasting, which is why they care. NPR is digging into its vaults for a new social media project. The kids should like that, right? Highlighting reports from its archives. Kids should like that, right? The network is digging up stories from 1984 and sharing them via Tumblr and Twitter. The project selections have included an author interview in which Susan Stamberg learned to use colored pencils, and a report about working women who traded high heels for sneakers while commuting to their jobs. Please give. Melody Kramer, an associate editor and digital strategist at NPR. Digital strategist is leading the experimental. It's an experiment, the experimental project. It's just an experiment. It could blow up. Kramer, a former web producer for Fresh Air who built the show's digital audience via Tumblr and Twitter, returned to public radio last year to head up new digital projects at NPR. To manage NP Archives, see what they did there? NP Archives. She teamed up with All Things Considered producer Art Silverman. And he's helping to contextualize the material. See, Susan Stanberg didn't know how to use colored pencils before. That would be the context, wouldn't it? Quote, "We want to showcase how much is in our archives," Kramer said. "And from a social media standpoint, I'm interested in seeing if I can make the archives go viral." How about bacterial, at least? She drew inspiration from earlier NPR projects that delved into history, such as the Twitter feed Today in 1963, to provide as-it-happened updates about the Kennedy assassination and key moments in the civil rights movement. The feed drew more than 24,000 followers during its six-month run. Kanye West has that many in his pockets. Kramer chose 1984 in part because it was 30 years ago? No, because it was the earliest year of content archives available in the library housed at NPR. No, they didn't. Earlier material resides at the Library of Congress, and she'd have to take the bus or something. Because the year also encompassed national elections and a Summer Olympics, Kramer plans to use NP Archives to compare the network's coverage of those events 30 years ago to how reporters will cover them this year. Of course, this year is not a presidential election year, unlike 1984. Memo to Kramer. She also hopes to integrate behind-the-scenes photos and videos of NPR staffers at work in 1984, offering insight into techniques that defined radio reporting in the analog era, such as editing tape with razor blades. They didn't do that, did they? Yeah, until 2008. NPR's library team is recruiting volunteers to transcribe older reports. Please donate your time, won't you, to this very... We need a transcript of how Susan Stanberg lived. Kramer hopes NP Archives will become a testing ground for ways to revive archival content online. Quote, I'm going to be using this throughout the year as an experimental sandbox type space, unquote. And on a more comical note, after a website published an article this week reporting that PBS aired a three-part, quote, documentary, unquote, series about the, quote, public employee pension crisis, unquote, and the primary donor, the major donor to that project was a reclusive billionaire named John Arnold, who has spent 15 years campaigning against public employee pensions. Late this past week, WNET, the originating station, announced nothing was wrong. Mr. Arnold exerted no influence on the journalism in the documentaries, and they're giving the money back. Oh, please give. A plea that seems even more heartfelt when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, yeah, now it works. I figured it out.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, safe, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
News of the Atom with our friend Addie the Atom. Addie? You're in costume.
Yeah. I'm dressed like a molecule.
You're fooling everybody, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a good time.
A record level of radioactive cesium has been found in groundwater beneath a coastal levee east of reactor turbine buildings at the, where do you think?
Fook.
Number one, according to the plant operator, a record level of radioactive cesium.
We're about breaking records, aren't we?
We are. TEPCO said on Thursday that 37,000 becquerels, hey, have a becquerel or two, won't you, on me, of cesium-134 and 93,000 becquerels of cesium-137 were detected per liter of groundwater sampled earlier that day in a monitoring well on the levee. The total reading of 130,000 is the highest ever observed in groundwater beneath that levee. The same sampling well had produced a cesium reading of 76,000 becquerels a day earlier.
Going up.
The monitoring well is located close to underground pits, which are being flooded with inflows of highly radioactive water from reactor and turbine buildings. So it's all going well. Highly radioactive water leaked from the bases of those pits to nearby areas immediately following the triple meltdown. TEPCO officials say they believe the radioactive contaminants originated from those earlier leaks. So everything's
under control.
Yes, it is, because the water just continues to irradiate all and sundry. Thousands of documents obtained by television station King 5 in Seattle reveal a lack of action and a denial of the serious nature of a spill of nuclear waste at the Hanford nuclear facility in eastern Washington. The records were generated by the Washington State Department of Ecology during its investigation of the spill, which occurred 2 years ago in the central region of the site. Employees of a government contractor were inspecting large metal boxes stored in the open air on a bed of gravel.
What could go wrong?
When they discovered radioactive liquid beside one of the boxes, the containers with obvious signs of rust and deterioration was thought to be storing only solid materials such as piping, gloves, and masks discarded during decades of plutonium production at Hanford. A manager with the U.S. Department of Energy gave a courtesy call to an ecology inspector the next day, reporting that workers had found some contamination on the ground, but, quote, at this time there's no reason to believe that the contamination is coming from the interior corner of the box. The manager blamed snow or ice melt coming off the box. 2 weeks later, a meeting showed what the Department of Energy didn't report. The contractor workers recorded very hot alpha readings from the liquid on the ground. One of the only things at Hanford that emits alpha particles is, Addie?
Plutonium,
yes. Those numbers would indicate a serious problem, said a retired radiation specialist from Hanford, whose job was to record contamination levels there for 22 years. The first thing I would do after verifying that level of alpha contamination would be to get away from it. Ecology, the Washington State Department thereof, investigated the incident. Within 3 weeks, confirmed the box was leaking and that there had been a dangerous waste spill into the environment. But Energy Department employees said they didn't agree.
Reasonable people can differ.
Somebody misinterpreted the fact there were drips as being drips of something other than rainwater, said a spokesperson for the Energy Department. When a reporter asked why there would be readings of radioactivity from snowmelt or rainwater,
spokesperson shrugged.
Spokesperson didn't have an answer, saying only, quote, I don't know that answer. 2 years ago, lab results came in with conclusive evidence. That's a month later after the leak was discovered, after the liquid was discovered. Dangerous toxics, including lead, mercury, americium, and plutonium, had spilled onto the gravel. If a tiny fraction of plutonium gets in your lungs, of course, you're likely to get lung cancer, if not worse. Department of Energy and contractors stuck to their theory the box never leaked, according to 2,000 state records examined by the television station, and that there was no release of radiation into the open air. State investigators were blocked for weeks from getting records about the incident and access to the site to take samples for themselves. This is the most fascinating leak of rainwater my career has seen or heard of, wrote one investigator. Said another, the U.S. Department of Energy is consistently in denial.
I thought they were in the Columbia.
Two cracks were discovered in a concrete floor near radioactive water. Not only high becquerel content. Two cracks discovered in a concrete floor near radioactive water storage tanks on the grounds of the stricken Fook No. 1 plant this week. A Officials with TEPCO said some of the contaminated water from the melting snow blanketing the area may have seeped into the ground through the cracks. Workers discovered the cracks stretching 12 meters and 8 meters respectively near a group of storage tanks where 300 tons of highly radioactive water was found in August last year to have leaked. So cracks wouldn't be an ongoing problem for that.
I don't think your sarcasm is merited.
It's never merited. Électricité de France, the biggest nuclear operator in France, is facing delays in carrying out work on its atomic reactors that could pose safety and quality issues, according to the French nuclear regulator. They're overwhelmed by the work that they themselves decided to carry out.
Here's a lesson there. Defer maintenance.
A case study in Sweden has shown that critically endangered European eels are being lost when they're sucked into the local nuclear power station's cooling system.
Not funny.
A process to pump the eels back into the sea could be beneficial to this species, the researchers conclude. Nuclear power stations, as you know, require large amounts of water for their cooling systems. 80% of the reactors in the world use water from natural ecosystems, drawing water from the sea or a nearby river and pumping it back after use. The practice can trap and kill aquatic species which are sucked up with the water. Technology used to pump fish and other species back into the environment could be valuable, especially for species of conservation concerns, say the researchers.
I could live without eels.
They could live without you. In costume, I mean. A confidential study by the Energy Department has concluded that completing a controversial nuclear fuel factory in South Carolina may cost billions of dollars more than the department has previously promised, according to government officials and industry sources. The study, conducted for the Energy Secretary, found that after finishing and then operating the factory to help get rid of Cold War-era plutonium as part of an arrangement with Russia, it would likely cost a total of $25 billion to $30 billion on top of the $4 billion spent on its construction so far. That amount is so high, the official said, that the Obama administration is leaning towards embracing what was described as some other option for dealing with the 34 tons of weapons-grade plutonium that the plant was supposed to help eliminate. Many officials now agree it's time for a shifting of gears.
I didn't think we had gears in nuclear plants.
I'm sure you do. You got pipes and you got valves. I'm sure you got gears. Accommodating such an expensive project within federal budgets that will be constrained for years to come is not considered feasible, said one official. But no clear alternative to the fuel factory has been chosen, Musletz announced. As a result, officials said, the administration will likely propose to keep funding the plant's construction at a level below the roughly $343 million appropriated. We can't afford it, so let's keep spending money on it.
And you think atoms are nuts.
The chief executive officer of a trade group representing the nuclear power industry warned Wall Street analysts this week that more power plants in the sector may be headed for shutdown. Marvin Fertel, president and chief executive officer of the Nuclear Energy Institute, cited the pending shutdown of Vermont Yankee as an example that the current competitive market that power producers bid into doesn't adequately value the reliability the nuclear industry's plants provide.
He's saying the market doesn't work.
Vermont Yankee's owner, Entergy, announced the plant would shut down at the end of this year. Fertel said, this is a perfectly rational business decision, but wrong for society as a whole. He also cited last year's shutdown of the Kewaunee nuclear plant in Wisconsin as another example of the flawed marketplace. The marketplace doesn't work. That's the problem with nuclear energy. Fix the damn market. He does say that. No, another person says that. The price structure in certain markets is distorted. This is from the Nuclear Energy Institute spokesperson. So nuclear plant operators are having a tough time with the economics. In states where the marketplace is more regulated and utility regulators guarantee the rate of return for energy companies, there's investment in new nuclear reactors, said the spokesperson. So just a state subsidy, that's all they're asking for.
That's not much. That's not much to ask.
And finally, the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant can expect to see more federal inspectors in coming months now that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has placed the plant in, placed the plant on a list with seven others as degraded.
That's not a critique. That's not a slam.
The downgrade had been expected for close to 3 months, but the NRC announced the action this week, saying it would trigger increased scrutiny.
I think we could all use that.
We could all use some increased scrutiny. I agree with you. We agree, Addy the Atom. News of our friend, clean, cheap, safe. Just give us a subsidy and fix the market. Our friend, the Atom.
Isn't she lovely? Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she precious? Less than 1 minute. Oh, I never knew through love we'd be making one as lovely as she. So very lovely, made from love. Doo ba doo doo ba doo doo. Isn't she lovely? Life and love all the same. Life is Aisha, the meaning of her name.
And it could not have been done without you conceived the one.
So very
lovely. Body,
so very lovely.
This is Le Show from New Orleans. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's check up on how things are going with our banking and financial community, aside from the incursion of private equity into the banking business. Here's a statement this week from John J. Mack, the former chairman and chief executive of Morgan Stanley. That's a fine, upstanding firm. He called for an end to the harsh words that have been hurled at Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, who a couple weeks ago, J.P. Morgan Chase said they would give him a big salary boost in a year where the bank has had paid billions to resolve legal problems. You know, just a reward for fines. And to Lloyd, and hurled also at Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs, over their pay. Mack said he would love to see people stop beating up on Lloyd and Jamie. I think that would make a lot of sense. He said a debate over compensation was necessary and healthy, but he emphasized chief executives should be judged according to their company's performance. Quote, as long as shareholders reward performance, what these companies delivered, we can argue, is it $10 million too much or $1 million too much, Mack said. Because J.P. Morgan Chase made a big profit despite paying out those billions. It almost as if the penalties weren't big enough to hurt, you think? All right, let's see how bankers are paid based on the performance of their companies. There's some evidence this week. Barclays Bank, big bank in England, you've heard of them. It said it's going to get rid of as many as 12,000 jobs and raise bonuses for investment bankers, despite the fact that its profits have gone down. Mr. Mack, Britain's third biggest bank, said up to 9% of employees could go as it tries to lower costs. It said it paid $3.9 billion in incentive awards last year, raising bonuses at the investment bank by 13% despite a slump in its profits. And we've learned also this week that many banks, both in the UK and here, are rejiggering the bonuses. Actually, this is happening, I think, in England first. They're rejiggering the bonuses so that they're no longer called bonuses, because the European community, Europe, Brussels, has put caps on bank bonuses. So they're calling, guess what? They're calling them something else. They're calling them allowances. You think I made this up? I did not. Other fine news From the financial end of things, employers are squeezing their workers' retirement savings, holding back, this is from Bloomberg, holding back on both the amount and the timing of matching funds deposited into employees' 401k accounts and dragging out vesting schedules. Taken together, these measures are making it more difficult for workers to save for old age. Major companies that engaged in such practices in recent years include Whole Foods, Facebook, Caesars Entertainment. Yeah, it's hard for them to make money because the slots are so... And J.P. Morgan Chase. The most frugal have been scaling back company matching funds for workers and setting lower limits for the maximum annual payment they'll make to a 401k, according to hundreds of government filings analyzed by Bloomberg. A difference of 3 percentage points on a match can add up to hundreds of thousands of dollars lost for employees over the course of their careers. Of course, they have the But, you know, we still live in a opportunity society where you get rewarded for the quality of work you do. Case in point, the company that performs many of the federal government's security background checks, that private contractor that checked, among others, on the security status of Edward Snowden before he got his... Hey, they received $16 million in incentive awards, even as that company took shortcuts in hundreds of thousands of its reviews, according to a congressional report released this week. Senior management of USIS, it conducts background checks for nearly half of potential U.S. government hires, received a sharp increase in bonuses, quote, when the alleged fraud began. It's almost as if, yes, it is. The nation's background security process has been in the spotlight, as you know. Last month, the Justice Department filed a complaint in a whistleblower's lawsuit and alleged the USIS did not fully perform background checks in 40% of the cases it handled. The government said USIS managers issued directives to, quote, clear out our shelves in order to hit revenue, unquote. Their defense before the committee, they only perform background checks and don't have the authority to grant clearances. But they didn't perform the checks. But they got bonuses. And finally, in news of high finance, Michael Jackson's estate is in the midst of a fight with the Internal Revenue Service. The agency has told Jackson's executors that the estate owes $505 million in taxes and an additional $197 million in penalties. Jackson's executors placed his net worth at the time of his death at slightly more than $7 million. The IRS placed it at $1.1 billion, a difference so vast it looks like a typo. This according to the L.A. Dog Trainer. Jackson's return was so inaccurate, the IRS said, that it qualified for a gross valuation misstatement penalty, which would allow the government to double the usual 20% penalty. This is a penalty almost never applied. I've never even heard of the gross valuation misstatement penalty being asserted, said an estate tax expert in Los Angeles. Most of the dispute is over the value of Jackson's image, along with his interest in a trust that includes the rights to Beatles songs. The estate valued Jackson's likeness at $2,100. The IRS put it at $434 million. This reminds me, in the O.J. Simpson civil trial, after the jury had found him liable for the killings, his defense against being assessed $33 million in damages was, hey, you've made him notorious. How's he going to make money? So the attorney was saying this as he was signing footballs for money. The estate put the value of Michael Jackson's interest in the trust that owns the Beatles songs at zero. The IRS put it at $469 million. Neither the IRS nor Jackson's attorney would comment, leaving room for others.
Songs. Then he wrote them down. Called themselves the Beatles. Couldn't be denied. I bought their catalog. And it opened up. Now it ain't worth nothing. No, it ain't worth nothing.
in Vegas. But that's a sucker's town. I call myself the king of pop. I've gone and pawned my crown. Now it ain't worth nothing. No, it ain't worth nothing.
Gone and I don't know why. She let out this morning like a rusty shot in a hollow sky. She left me without warning. Sooner than the dogs could bark, faster than the sun rose, down to the banks on an old mule car. She took a flatboat across the shallow, left me in my tears to drown. She left a baby daughter, now the river's wide and deep and brown. She's crossing muddy water, baby's crying and the daylight's gone. That big old tree is groaning in a rush of wind and a river song. I can hear my true love moaning, crying for her baby child. Oh, crying for her husband, crying for that river's wife. Take her from her loved ones, left me in my tears to drown. She left a baby daughter, now the river's wide and deep and brown. And she's crossing muddy waters, now the river's wide and deep and brown. She's crossing muddy water.
This is LeShow, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
With a nod to Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thank you for letting me do this, sir. The story of a Long Island mom who replied to a small child's birthday invitation with an ugly homophobic rant is a hoax, two New York radio hosts say. K98.3, a Long Island radio station, told listeners the story of Sophia, a 7-year-old girl whose two dads decided to throw her a party. The friend of Sophia's mom, Tommy, allegedly sent the invitation back with the following screed: Tommy will not attend. I do not believe in what you do and will not subject my innocent son to your lifestyle. Unquote. The station posted photos of the invitation on their Facebook page along with Beth's phone number, saying she welcomed anyone who was upset with what she wrote to contact her themselves. The story went viral, much like gathering widespread media attention. But in an apology posted to the K98.3 website, radio host Steve and Leanna admitted they made the whole thing up. The story was totally fictitious and created by the two of us, they said. This was done without the knowledge of K98.3 management or ownership. We were attempting to spur a healthy discussion on a highly passionate topic, but we made a mistake by misleading the listeners into thinking this specific situation actually existed. We're very sorry that we perpetrated this falsehood, even after it was clear it had taken on a life of its own. We deeply apologize for violating your trust. DJs, violating your trust. When will it stop? Dateline Geneva international mediator Lakshar Brahimi apologized to the Syrian people for the lack of progress at peace talks in Geneva after the second round ended this weekend with little more than an agreement to meet again. As it became clear, the talks had not even broached the subject of a change of leadership in Syria. Both France and Britain, who backed the opposition, blamed President Assad for the impasse. I'm very, very sorry and apologize to the Syrian people. Their hopes were very, very high here that something would happen here, Brahimi told journalists. An early agreement to evacuate people from the besieged city of Homs had raised false expectations the talks would make greater progress. Talk to Hans Blix. Things are looking good. Oscar Pistorius, the Paralympic athlete accused of murdering his girlfriend, broke his long public silence this week to describe her death as a devastating accident that consumes me with sorrow. Pistorius tweeted for the first time in a year, posting a few words from my heart and a link to his website where it said, "No words can adequately capture my feelings about the devastating accident. Pain and sadness consumes me with sorrow. I will carry it with me for the rest of my life." He goes on trial very soon. No known relationship. A British lawmaker apologized for remarks comparing Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to Jewish suffering during the Holocaust. Yasmin Qureshi of the Labour Party made her apology in a statement for remarks she made 2 days earlier in the parliament. "In no way did I mean to equate events in Gaza with the Holocaust. I apologize for any offense caused," she said. "I'm also personally hurt if people thought I meant this." Just lay off the Holocaust comparisons and the Hitler stuff. Never works. AOL's chief executive officer had to backtrack on a change in his company's 401k policy after his comments defending the idea fueled an employee outcry. He said AOL needed the retirement plan tweaked to help offset costs such as 2 employee pregnancies that resulted in distressed babies with more than $1 million each in medical expenses. Over the weekend, he reversed the decision in a memo to employees. "I made a mistake, and I apologize for my comments." This was Armstrong's second apology in about 6 months for a public controversy. No comment from Arianna Huffington. How about that? A weatherman for a Little Rock television station offered an apology Tuesday after a winter storm that had been expected to drop accumulating snow failed to develop in central Arkansas. Todd Yakubian, meteorologist for KATV, wasn't the only weathercaster whose prediction didn't pan out, but he was in a small minority in one respect. He took to his Facebook page and blog first thing Tuesday to apologize for forecasting a snow that never fell. Quote, "I don't think anyone takes it as hard as I do when it comes to busting a forecast. I'm very sorry." So that's what it's called in the trade. Busting a forecast. Lebanese skier Jackie Shamoun apologized this week after photos and a video from a shoot 3 years ago surfaced on the internet, causing a stir in her home country. Shamoun, who lives in Switzerland, said the material on the internet showing her topless, she showed her topless, was not part of the shoot for an Austrian skiing calendar. They were part of the making of shoot. The photos in the calendar show her scantily dressed, but not naked. "I apologize to all of you. I know that Lebanon is a conservative country, and this is not the image that reflects our culture. I fully understand if you want to criticize this," she said. She's in the Olympics. The what? So, Dateline Sochi, speaking of which, Irina Rodnina, the 3-time Olympic figure skating gold medalist, who was one of 2 Russian sports legends to light the Olympic cauldron at the opening ceremony, apologized this week for a racist tweet that appeared on her Twitter site 5 months ago about President Obama. "I respect the Obama family and apologize for not clearly stating earlier that I don't support the tweeted photo or racism in any form. My account was hacked, and I should have shown better judgment in my initial response and handling of the event." It was a photo of Obama with a banana. Russian spokesman, organizing committee chairman, said, "I want to stress the Olympics is not about politics." Yeah, that's why they're having it in Russia. That's why they're spending $51 billion on it. You know, because it's a good business deal. Dateline Houston Astros pitcher Jared Cosart has apologized after he reportedly used a gay slur to describe pop star Justin Bieber when he tweeted a message to a former teammate. Cosart deleted the offensive tweet from his account and apologized for a very poor choice of words. He also says in a tweet that the earlier post does not reflect who he is as a person. But as a pitcher, the apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns to you next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, and on the Mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internets at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through WWNO.org, SoundCloud.com, Sideshow Network, and iTunes. And it'd be just like fixing the market and giving the new people some money from your tax dollars. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. I mean some more money. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Thomas Walsh here at WWNO in New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this broadcast, playlist of the music heard here on, and a fabulous store, Cars I Talk T-shirts, ladies and gentlemen. Cars I Talk T-shirts at the store at harryshearer.com. And me, I'm twittering away at the Harry Shearer all week long. Don't ask me why. Hey, if you get over to England this week, episode 4, Nixon's the One, Thursday night, 9 p.m., Sky Arts One. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station for the Change is Easy radio network. So long from New Orleans.